I'd like to begin with a comment that is only relevant as remote background to my remarks. The problem for Wittgensteinians now is one which I think Lars Herzberg drew attention to this morning. How are we going to integrate Wittgenstein into a mainstream philosophy? And there's a huge industry commenting upon Wittgenstein. There's a huge, an almost equally huge industry producing texts of various sorts. The big problem is, what is this all relevant to, since Wittgenstein seems to be becoming decoupled from analytic philosophy, or becoming an esoteric part of analytic philosophy. An esoteric part of philosophy in general. I think this is a big problem and needs to be discussed in its own right. I'm very happy that Lars talked about that this morning. And by the way, I think it's not only a problem about analytic philosophy, it's a problem about philosophy as such. Well, one aspect of that problem involves my personal interests and my professional training in the history of philosophy. I began working on Wittgenstein because there was no... I'm a leftist. My initial work in Wittgenstein, going back before Wittgenstein's Vienna, was motivated by the desire to figure out where Wittgenstein fits into the history of philosophy. People said then he didn't fit into the history of philosophy at all, but that still remains to some extent plausible. He certainly doesn't fit in very well. So how does Wittgenstein fit into the history of philosophy? All plausible answers are not very helpful in the end. And I think we should be very grateful to Rudolf Haller for examining, in his questions about Wittgenstein, a number of general hypotheses about the relationship of Wittgenstein to positivism, about the relationship of Wittgenstein to Neo-Kantianism, to show how difficult it is to get a rich reading of Wittgenstein out of any of these, against any of these backgrounds. I think that's one important point. This is a hard question. And so the efforts to identify Wittgenstein as a positivist, as a rationalist, as a Kantian, as a pragmatist, as a skeptic, all have their point, but none of them really succeed. And it seems almost to be a kind of mystery about how, where Wittgenstein comes from in this sense. Well, should it be? Brian McGinnis has insisted for some time now that this should be less of a mystery than it is, because in fact Wittgenstein has told us where he's come from. And with respect to his concept of philosophy, for example, I left myself be influenced by Boltzmann, Hertz, Schopenhauer, Frege, Russell, Krauss, Lewis, Weininger, Spengler, and Sraffa. Now, I have been increasingly inclined to take this list very seriously, and since I did some work in the early 90s on Heinrich Hertz and found almost a completely new access to Wittgenstein's views about philosophy there, I'm inclined to think that the beginning of this list is very, very important. Hertz and Boltzmann. My subject today is, in fact, Boltzmann as influencing Ludwig Wittgenstein, and also as a philosopher in his own right who needs to be rediscovered, as does Hertz, because neither one of them, especially Hertz, fits into any kind of traditional way of looking at the role of the philosopher and philosophy. Okay, so our story begins with Wittgenstein and how exactly the exact details of his meeting, his intellectual encounter with Boltzmann are not known, at least not known to me. But this story begins most likely when Wittgenstein was 14 years old, and with Wittgenstein, the 14-year-old philosopher of science. Which I think is in itself rather interesting. When we look back at Boltzmann in the light of Wittgenstein's mature conception of philosophy, that's to say, what he's thinking about in 1931 and thereafter, I think we discover the rationes seminalis of his mode of philosophizing, as it were. And these include a number of common modes of expression, a number of common argumentative strategies, and a number of common philosophical concerns, which I'll try to sketch for you. The center of Boltzmann's epistemology is the notion that we come to know nature on the basis of pictures, Bilder, that we form by making analogies to guide us in our search for scientific explanations. Interestingly, in this connection, Boltzmann considers Christopher Columbus to be an outstanding theorist on the basis of the way his new bold picture of the world radically advanced knowledge. And in this context, he mentions Columbus alongside the great experimentalist Michael Faraday and alongside J. Robert Meyer, the first one with the law of conservation of energy. And he says that all of these people produced subjective models upon which they acted, models which in fact don't correspond to nature on a one-to-one basis, but as it were, this is my analogy here, anticipate the contours of a terrain that a scientist like Columbus proposes to explore as precisely as he can. Our subjective ideal of clarity and precision cannot in and of itself rule out vagueness in our concepts a priori, precisely because these models cannot have a one-to-one correspondence with what they would map. Furthermore, these models do not imply that we're always in a position to define crucial concepts precisely, something Boltzmann emphasizes. And he gives two examples, species and number. Are two among many crucial concepts that science profitably employs but cannot define. Clarity for Boltzmann will not be in the first instance a matter of defining concepts exactly, but of the logical coherence of models. Thus Boltzmann urges scientists to formulate their conjectures in the form of mathematical models that will guide our inquiries into nature along a sure path. These models will be useful to the extent that they're completely clear. Their mathematical structure ensures this clarity. For that reason, Boltzmann admonishes scientists not to bring experience into the process too early, for it may turn out to be counterproductive with respect to the clarity of the concept the scientists use. Herein lies the main difference between Columbus and the modern scientist. Now, Boltzmann also emphasizes the role of ingenuity and imagination in our efforts to understand recalcitrant nature, citing the example of Maxwell and anticipating Wittgenstein and others who would question whether the successful scientist should more appropriately be termed a discoverer or an inventor. Subsequent experience shows the value of our models inasmuch as it contradicts or confirms what we've claimed is true. Unlike Mach, but like Popper, Boltzmann is a curious kind of realist. The speculative character of our theories and the arbitrary elements in our models does not disturb Boltzmann because he sees the activity of being involved in the theoretical enterprise in a similar way to, say, Imre Lakatos or Stephen Kuhlman later, as a collective Socratic self-critical one. Quote, its very defects are grounded in its own nature, and it is theory itself that uncovers its own errors. Unquote. He goes so far as to insist that the empirical correctness and conceptual clarity of our models is so deeply anchored into the very activity of modeling, into the very theoretical process itself, that it was superfluous of his highly esteemed colleague Hertz to make correctness and clarity explicit demands upon our models of nature. It's, by the way, very significant that Boltzmann makes no mention whatsoever of the third Hertzian property of models, that their rhetorical appropriateness at all, because I think this is the factor in Hertz that most influenced Wittgenstein via. Boltzmann, in any case, further emphasizes that it's in the very nature of theory, as subjective analogy, that it always be underdetermined, as we would say. Beyond that, he scandalized many of his contemporaries, and one must remember Boltzmann died in 1906, fairly early on, and anticipated Bohr's approach to quantum mechanics by insisting there could well be a number of true theories that could account for a given phenomenon. Something nowadays doesn't surprise us, but then was extremely surprising. The aim is not to explain nature on the basis of some causal agency behind it, but to describe natural phenomena as comprehensively as possible on the basis of fallible analyses that reduce complex natural processes to simple components which are qualitatively identical with those processes. Yet Boltzmann was not unaware of the controversy surrounding such a novel constructivist view of knowledge. From Mach onwards, one might even say, from Descartes onwards, the possibility of producing genuine knowledge on the basis of mathematical models was confronted with the question of how we could be certain that the clear and distinct models we make for ourselves of natural phenomena in fact refer to something in the world, something outside of our minds, the problem of solipsism. From the point of view of the subject, the clarity of ideas, like the intensity of our experiences, is no simple guarantee that our ideas and experiences correspond to anything. This was especially vexing for Boltzmann as an advocate of the theory of atoms at a time when they could not be observed. How could he establish that they were anything more than figments of his imagination? The subjective origins of the theoretical enterprise is emphasized by Boltzmann to the extent that he in fact refers to the solitary theorist as indeed a kind of solipsist, spinning out ideas that turn out either to be adapted empirically to reality or to be rejected by it. The evolutionist flair of his remarks is completely deliberate, for Boltzmann was an enthusiastic Darwinist. Thus, the evolutionary perspective is also very important for him in his confrontation with what he calls the Verwirrung, the aberration, if you like, of solipsism. The problem of solipsism, on his view, has two aspects, one bearing upon the existence of the external world, and another bearing upon the existence of other minds. And both of these themes turn up later, as subjects of studies by Burke and Russell. With respect to the first, with respect to the problem of the external world, Boltzmann claimed that the very resistance that the world makes to our conceptions, in fact, turns out to be a source confirming their objectivity. The world collides, as it were, with the solipsist when he fails to take the proper course of action, thus jolting him out of his reveries and selecting the objective core by separating it from the arbitrary subjective husk of his representations. And this seems to anticipate operant and evolutionary epistemology. And I mentioned this because it helps to explain how it is that certain parallels between Wittgenstein and Popper, for example, would have come into existence historically. As for what has become known as the problem of other minds, that is, the sensations of others, Boltzmann argues that these sensations are known by analogy with our own. He emphasizes not on the basis of a mechanical analogy, but a psychological analogy. In this context, Boltzmann makes a remark that anticipates Carnap's logical construction of the world and sketches succinctly the contrary position to Wittgenstein's celebrated rejection of private language in the Philosophical Investigations. Quote, "Our own world picture would be ideally perfect if, for each of our sensations, we had a sign, and furthermore a rule, by which to construct from these signs the occurrence of all our future sensations. Very clear, a brief statement of the problem. Be that as it may, since the other pulls her hand out of the fire in the same agitated way that I do, I infer she's had the same experience of being burned that I do. However, with respect to other minds, the need to adopt a common language that we all must learn implies that I must describe the sensations of others in the same way I describe my own. In such matters, certainty is linked to common judgment. It should be noted in the course of developing his arguments against solipsism, Boltzmann employs a clever thought experiment involving a machine that, quote, looked like a human body and behaved like one, unquote. He concludes in a behaviorist vein that, quote, nobody could prove that it was less aware of itself than a human, unquote. Both the theme and the strategy for dealing with it on the basis of a thought experiment, although not the substance of the issue, are highly reminiscent of what we've subsequently become familiar with in Wittgenstein's later philosophy, and they're typical of Boltzmann. Clearly, the common concern with solipsism manifesting itself in Boltzmann as a need to refute it, and in Wittgenstein as a need both to indicate why it forces itself upon the reflective mind, but nevertheless is philosophically absurd, runs deeply through both of these thinkers. As far as Wittgenstein is concerned, it's been clear since David Peirce published his two-volume study, The False Prison, that all of his philosophizing is linked to a lifelong concern with solipsism that he probably takes over from Boltzmann. So it's hardly absurd to suggest that this concern is itself linked to the views of his first mentor, even if Wittgenstein would vigorously object to the idea that we know other minds per analogiam, as Boltzmann claims. Even more revealing of an affinity with Wittgenstein's mature conception of philosophy, and thus more directly relevant to my main theme here, however, is Boltzmann's analysis of how philosophical problems arise as we become dazzled by the efficacy of our own mental constructs. The idea that knowledge is facilitated by building models of what we take to be reality implies that our analogies are merely of local significance. Philosophical problems arise precisely when we try to generalize the significance of our constructs and pronounce upon reality as a totality. The habits that we've acquired, according to which we're able to cope with the world on the basis of subsuming the particular phenomenon under the more general, tempt us to produce a unitary picture of the world. Thus, residual dissatisfaction at our inability to divine concepts like number tempts us to overshoot the mark by producing metaphysical explanations to fill the gap. And the German phrase here is die Anpassung schießt das Ziel hinaus. The result is that reason plummets itself into contradictions of the sort that Kant described under the rubric of antinomies, that is to say, a situation in which both of a pair of contradictory propositions can be proved when it seeks total representations for reality. I've introduced Kant here, and Boltzmann seems to rely upon Kant without saying so. The philosopher, as opposed to the scientist, seeks explanations of the given. Which explanations are of a different logical type from the empirically given explanandum? Thus arises a need to explain our experience in terms of a sort of being, that is to say, God, whose nature is wholly different, of a wholly different order than what we experience. Furthermore, this tendency to stand in awe of the fact that anything exists at all seems to be so deeply rooted in the nature of the human mind that it's inextinguishable. Philosophers' obsession with questions of existence, of a sort that is wholly foreign to scientists, was virtually perverse in Boltzmann's eyes, a matter to be handled by a philosophical pathologist, which in some ways how he saw himself. What we really need is a description of
particular phenomena, which, as we've seen, should reduce problematic complexes into simple components of the same logical type. In philosophy, we look for something more profound, and in so doing, on Boltzmann's view, we lose sight of the simplest things, which turn out to be the most inexplicable, the most trivial, the most puzzling, as a result. In order to remedy this, quote, we must work against the irresistible urge to apply the laws of thought even where they overshoot the mark, phrase once again, so that in the end, this urge gradually disappears altogether, unquote. For Boltzmann, the laws of thought, too, are the results of evolutionary development. Thus, Boltzmann would once allow that they have an a priori function with respect to thinking, but at the same time deny that they're absolutely certain. Philosophers must be disabused of confusing these two. This would involve disabusing idealists, in the sense of philosophers obsessed by ideal cases, of their tendency to view the world from a one-sided standpoint, Boltzmann's term. This one-sided standpoint consists chiefly of posing questions of such a vast scope that they cannot be answered. In stark contrast to metaphysics, quote, natural science appears completely to lose from sight the large and the general question. But all the more splendid is the success when groping in the thicket of special questions, we suddenly find a small opening that allows a hitherto undreamt of outlook on the whole. Unquote. Galileo's inclined plane, which showed bodies of differing weights falling at the same speed, as an example of a case where a big metaphysical problem was resolved scientifically on the basis of a seemingly small technical innovation. Thus, science handles unanswerable big problems by reducing them to small, manageable, bite-sized questions. Indeed, Boltzmann viewed the main objective in philosophy as that of, quote, giving a clear account of the inappropriateness of overshooting the mark, as we've seen a recurrent metaphor in Boltzmann. Philosophy philosophy should at once eliminate the tangles, the verwicklungen, that lead to contradictions in thought and create a system such that, quote, it stood out clearly when a question is not justified, so that the drive towards asking it would gradually die away, unquote. This surely is the remote origin of Wittgenstein's notion that the aim of philosophy should be to show the fly the way out of the fly model, to put the philosopher's mind to rest by eliminating the temptation to rise tormenting because unanswerable questions. More the Hertzian formulation. Fully in the spirit of Boltzmann, Wittgenstein insists that he must find or invent a series of intermediate cases to wean philosophers away from their one-sided examples. For Boltzmann, a philosophy that would eliminate the drive to pose such questions alone would be worthy of the name of the queen of the sciences. Thus, on Boltzmann's view, in contrast to, say, Mach and Russell, it's clearly an error to identify philosophy and natural science. In his popular writings, philosophy is normally below the sciences, but he envisions at least one situation, or one kind of philosophy that might even be above the sciences. That is to say, as a clarification of the methods of the sciences, or as epistemological or cosmological speculation, but never on an equal footing with them, as Wittgenstein would reiterate. In the matter of the demarcation between scientific truth and existential truth, as we would put it, Boltzmann is absolutely unambiguous. Quote, the problems of life are higher, so he doesn't use the term. He insists with Goethe, anticipating both the conclusion of the Tractatus, but also what Wittgenstein would say about religion and culture of value, namely, quote, theory is gray compared with life, unquote. And this is clearly an allusion to Faust Part 1. Grau, teurer Freund, ist alle Theorie in Grün des Lebens goldener Baum. That's good. Moreover, like the Wittgenstein of uncertainty and Blaise Pascal, Boltzmann will insist that religion and science belong to different orders of experience. Boltzmann seems to have been a devout Catholic in an age of Catholic philosophical revival, the beginnings of the Renouveau Catholique, stemming from the encyclical Aeterni Patris, beginning of the 90s, or more or less coinciding with his high points in Boltzmann's career, would indicate that this would have given him some kind of problem here, and so he would have had some motivation for distinguishing these two orders of experience. Be that as it may, these two orders, the scientific order and Wittgenstein would later call the higher, relate to one another as the inside and the outside of our experience, which have to be pictured or imagined in completely different ways. Boltzmann writes, "Nothing is more perverse than linking religious concepts which rest on a quite different and immeasurably firmer basis with the vacillating subjective picture that we form of external things," unquote. It seems clearly to prefigure the relationship between logic and mysticism in the tractatus. So here we've reached a point where we should begin to reconsider the implications of Boltzmann's influence upon Wittgenstein for the latter's development. As we've stated, the impact of Wittgenstein, the impact of Boltzmann on Wittgenstein, will help us to understand some of Wittgenstein's own claims about how unoriginal he was. It'll also help us to understand the curious fact that K.T. Fun, Peter Winch, and others have remarked upon, namely that the later philosophy is probably, in some sense, in some aspects, in Nietzsche at least, earlier than the early philosophy. Something I've always been intrigued by and tend to believe myself nowadays. We shall proceed from the latter to the former point. In order to do so, we should begin by reconsidering how Boltzmann laid the foundation for Wittgenstein's subsequent development. And this, of course, is my reconstruction. It will probably displease some people. That, in turn, involves reconsidering what Wittgenstein got from the other figures he mentioned on his list, as it bears upon as much as it bears upon his legacy from Boltzmann. And I hope to produce a certain sketch of his development that will, could later be filled out more fully. In all of Boltzmann's philosophizing, it's clear that his hero and authority is Heinrich Hertz. Wittgenstein seems to have come from Boltzmann to Hertz. Boltzmann continually emphasized how the Hertzian view, that it was the mathematical structure of our models of nature, which conferred their usefulness upon them, which was the key to understanding how science explores nature. However, as we've seen, Boltzmann failed to understand why Hertz was so adamant about insisting upon the mathematical permissibility and the empirical correctness of models or theories. Well, this was simply presupposed to begin with, self-evident. For Boltzmann, and that's just the way it was, in all of that, Boltzmann failed to recognize, as Wittgenstein did not, that there was for Hertz also a third, absolutely crucial dimension, a rhetorical dimension to our models, which was not merely of superficial significance, but which helped us to understand how generalizing our models could confuse us, and which suggested that if the metaphysical problems of, say, physics, with its notion of force, arose in the language of physics, then they had to be solved not by prohibiting the use of these misleading metaphysical expressions in that language, but by articulating the matter in question in an alternative language, in terms of an alternative model, such that the problem that has tormented us disappears in the very alternative representation itself. It, that is to say, purely immanently. Thus, in the spirit of Boltzmann, on the basis of Hertzian views of the clarificatory powers of alternative representations, Wittgenstein's tractatus would show on the basis of truth tables that there was absolutely no need for axioms in logic. It was Hertz, above all, who gave Wittgenstein the crucial clue about the importance of showing in philosophy. Jumping over Schopenhauer, to whom it would be necessary to return on another occasion, for a moment, let's consider what the adolescent Wittgenstein, with his background from Boltzmann especially, and from Hertz, might have learned from Gottlob Frege, that's continuous with Boltzmann. I think two points are particularly important with respect to how Frege could be seen as relating to the philosophical claims of Boltzmann. The idea that number could indeed be rigorously defined, and the notion that mathematics is in fact a part of formal logic, both of which were deeply rooted in Frege's thinking, as everyone knows, from the Begriffsschrift onwards, and central to the program that he developed for analytic philosophy. If logic, which here means the notion of a logical function, can be employed to define number, we have the solution to one problem that Boltzmann had in fact written off, and that would have to be tremendously impressive to somebody who had come from Boltzmann, especially so. Moreover, if logic was at the heart of mathematics, then the secret of modeling was to be found there. So we can see on the face of it what might have led the juvenile Wittgenstein, still a teenager, from Boltzmann to Hertz to Frege, a deepening of our understanding of depicting the exterior of experience, just as Schopenhauer and Weininger later would aid him in depicting the interior of the world. Thus he could enlist enthusiastically as a volunteer in Bertrand Russell's campaign to finish the job of eliminating arbitrariness from logic that Frege had left to it, as it were. Let's know the simplification. Russell's service to logic had been to show on the basis of an analytic technique, the so-called theory of descriptions, that the apparent logical form of a proposition is not its real one. In so doing, Russell demonstrated how the truth of propositions required to stand in an isomorphic relation to the situations they represent, and thus are not mere analogies, as Boltzmann had insisted. Here, Boltzmann's notion of models as analogies was abandoned for the view that models represent reality with an absolute exactitude. The basis of this view is the notion of the bivalence of the proposition. A proposition to be a proposition must be true or false. No secrets there. Our propositions could not reach out to reality, as Wittgenstein puts it, if that were not the case. So even if Hertz could give Wittgenstein the crucial clue to undermining the notion of the philosophical logic, or logical theory of the sort that Frege and Russell had striven for, with the truth table, under Wittgenstein's point, which would definitively show all of the possibilities for distinguishing genuine propositions from pseudo-propositions, isomorphism would remain absolutely central to the early Wittgenstein. Thus, his early view of knowledge would depart in central ways from that of Boltzmann, while nevertheless building upon it. And I think these first set of statements from proposition 4.11 to 4.116, where first set of statements about philosophy clearly reflect some thoughts about Boltzmann. I mean, bringing Darwin into the picture, who seldom is discussed by Wittgenstein, for example, and the whole idea of the notion of entanglement in psychology, this trabeculum turns up again. Nevertheless, I don't want to make too much about that. Let's turn to Wittgenstein's later philosophy. As we know, he later came to have second thoughts about the matter of representation. He criticized his own view in the Tractatus that atomic propositions are wholly independent of one another. His own reflections on the ways in which the whole system of colors is presupposed in any specific sensory discrimination whatsoever provided one set of grounds for that. To see that an object is blue is at one and the same time to judge that it is neither green nor violet. Another source of morphic relationship to the world. Thus the door to the philosophical investigations was open. In that work, suddenly, however, Boltzmann's notion of the primacy of analogies and examples in epistemology would once again come to the fore, as Wittgenstein would insist upon the epistemological primacy of the notion of following rules, where there are no explicit rules, there are only examples to follow. In short, the way beyond Frege and Russell was at least to some extent a way back to Boltzmann. For example, it would involve returning to the idea that human thought is rooted in evolution. But Wittgenstein would distinguish, as Boltzmann had not, or at least had not always, between evolution as a theory and evolution as a description of our natural history. I'll skip over a little bit here. I want to look now at some specific points from the philosophical investigations, which I think echo quite clearly Boltzmann. I'm afraid I must read some more text at you, and I apologize for not having these things in perfect form. Let's start with a particularly striking use of the city metaphor. That's hardly accidental in Wittgenstein, given what Boltzmann had written earlier. Boltzmann describes the advancement of science in the pre-modern era as follows. Quote, just as an old town constantly through new buildings put up by industrious and enterprising citizens, unquote. This contrasts with the development of science in recent times, which Boltzmann says, quote, resembles rather that of a modern American town in which in a few decades grows from a village to a city of millions. End of quote. Wittgenstein asks what's lost in that development, as it were. Quote, our language can be seen as an ancient city, a maze of little streets and squares, of old and new houses, and of houses with additions from various periods. And this surrounded by a multitude of new boroughs with straight regular streets and uniform houses. Investigation 118. Wittgenstein insists that the most important facts with respect to illuminating philosophical problems are concealed from the philosopher because they're too simple and familiar, always before us and never problematic. In a similar vein, Boltzmann describes a situation in which, quote, many problems are like the question once put to a painter, what picture he was hiding behind the curtain, to which he replied, the curtain is the picture. For when requested to deceive experts by his art, he painted a picture representing a curtain. Unquote. Boltzmann goes on to ask, quote, is not perhaps the veil that conceals the nature of things from us like that painted curtain? Unquote. We've heard Lars Hetzberg citing Investigations 1.116, where Wittgenstein writes, when philosophers use the word knowledge, being, object, I, proposition, name, and try to grasp the essence of a thing, one must always ask oneself, is the word ever actually used this way in the language game, which is its actual home? What we do is bring words back from their metaphysical home to their everyday use. Unquote. Boltzmann, quote, progress in thinking must much rather be sought by eliminating concepts which experience tells us do not advance but mislead and even entangle us in contradictions. These forms of inference and concepts always arise when originally appropriate modes of thought are transferred to cases where they do not fit. Unquote. Like Wittgenstein, Boltzmann would continually ask the metaphysicians how they learned to use a particular word in the first place. Constant lose views of how our concepts go astray when we lose an overview of their origins, Boltzmann defines what it is to understand pragmatically. Quote, what then is meant by having a perfectly correct understanding of a mechanism? Everybody knows that the practical criterion for this consists in being able to handle it correctly. Unquote. Moreover, knowing what to do when the mechanism breaks down is an essential part of this. And this, Boltzmann insists, cannot be defined. However, that is not problematic as long as our understanding always leads to the correct action. Thus, Wittgenstein will insist that understanding is not at all a mental process, but a matter of being able to continue a series, knowing what to do next. Understanding shows itself, we might say, in the act of application. In a similar vein, Wittgenstein reminds us in what is on the surface the most unlikely place, namely in his lectures on aesthetics, that, quote, physics is connected with engineering, the bridge must not fall down, unquote. Whereas Boltzmann asserts, it's precisely the practical technician who, as a rule, treats the complicated formulae of electrical theory with a surer hand than many prospective physicists, unquote. Indeed, the point of Boltzmann's insistence that unlike the scientist, the engineer had literally to pay for his mistakes would hardly have been lost on an industrialist son like Wittgenstein, who would later insist, after all, that one should do this philosophy in a business-like manner. Now, of course, there are differences, there are many differences between Boltzmann and Wittgenstein. Certainly don't want to deny them. One major difference, for example, is that whereas Boltzmann argues against the imperialistic incursions of metaphysical philosophy into science, Wittgenstein, in his later phase, what I tend to call his mature phase, would free philosophy from the tendency to imitate science, and so doing, let in dubious metaphysical assumptions in the name of science through the back door. That would itself be a theme for another discussion. In conclusion, it's possible, of course, that such similarities are merely coincidental. I wouldn't deny that for a moment. But given Wittgenstein's way of mulling over texts and images that impressed him his whole life long, it is not likely. It is much more likely that he had internalized good chunks of Boltzmann's Populäre Schriften, as he had internalized good chunks of Frege's writings or Schubert's music, if he did not actually go back to the texts later, as he did to Hertz, whom he went back to throughout his life. Boltzmann was notorious for his wit and his snappy style, and as Brian McGinnis has pointed out, something of a celebrity in old Vienna, written about in the newspapers continually. And he was much appreciated, as a pundit, as a physicist, and philosopher. So it's fair to say that any Viennese account of Wittgenstein, and something that's near and dear to me, must begin with Boltzmann. It's clear that Boltzmann's writings led Wittgenstein to Hertz and probably to Schopenhauer, to whom Boltzmann seems to have had a love-hate relationship, as he did to other philosophers, I think especially Kant, whom he both criticized roundly but yet clearly built upon. The connection between philosophy and wit, and here I'm referring to a chapter that I've written in my Wittgenstein's Vienna Revisited on Karl Kraus and the importance of wit in Wittgenstein's later philosophy, is something that's tended to be neglected. Tony Kenny has pointed out, among other things, that Frege, in his best moments, can be extraordinarily witty. One should not underemphasize this connection either. Wittgenstein's belief that the metaphysicians of old were not to be ridiculed, but that their perspective had been transcended by the development of knowledge, certainly originates in Boltzmann, in whose writings the theme continually occurs. Their respective philosophical concerns, as well as their strategies, are surely significantly similar at a number of crucial points. Like Wittgenstein, Boltzmann sought to develop a way of putting the philosopher's tormented but fundamentally perverse questioning of the commonplace to rest once and for all. When Boltzmann said, as he did, philosophy gets on my nerves, he meant it literally. Boltzmann was what was then in his day called a neurasthenic. We would call him today a manic depressive person. Philosophy disturbed Boltzmann literally. And he sought to put his mind at rest by dissolving abstruse philosophical problems into manageable scientific ones. Is it entirely accidental that Wittgenstein would later come to see the philosopher's questioning of what is clear to normal people as a kind of madness that could only be cured by somebody capable of thinking yet crazier than traditional philosophers? Is it entirely accidental that he would strive to show how their intellectual torments were neither silly nor superfluous? I don't think so. To be sure, we cannot by a long way illuminate all of the questions surrounding Wittgenstein's concept of philosophy and its antecedents and its originality on the basis of Boltzmann, or indeed exclusively on the basis of historical arguments alone. But many of the issues turn upon the sort of philosophical estimate we make of his later views. Nor is it the point of the exercise to show that Wittgenstein was simply Boltzmann-ready views. That would be absurd. However, a close account of the genesis of Wittgenstein's mature conception of philosophy can take us a long way towards appreciating that there's much less arbitrariness than meets the eye in Wittgenstein's efforts to show the fly the way out of the fly bomb. Wittgenstein was not an Athena cropping out of the head of Zeus, fully grown, fully armed. He always insisted that he got his main ideas early in life. We do well to take him seriously in the matter. When we do so, we find that much that is mysterious and problematic about his view of philosophy, or seems to be, is to be understood in terms of a work of important but neglected philosophers like Boltzmann and Heinrich Hertz. Wittgenstein could well have said, with Newton, that he stood upon the shoulders of giants. In fact, he did so. The peculiarities of his philosophical development have tended to blind us to this fact. To explore his intellectual origins in the history of philosophy in no way involves compromising his place in the history of 20th century philosophy, but can only help to ensure it by showing skeptics how little is arbitrary in the strikingly original concept of philosophy that he developed with the help of Boltzmann, Hertz, Schopenhauer, Frege, Russell, Krauss, Lohse, Wagner, Spengler, and Strasser. Thank you very much.